Hey East Meets West listeners, in this episode, Albert and I are exploring the top content franchise acquisitions coming out of Asia in recent history. Many people are unaware of the value of content franchises, but when you think about it, the revenue they generate through views, merchandise, and retail sales, these acquisitions are some of the most valuable deals in the world. As an example, both Winnie the Pooh and Pokemon are franchises that have delivered over $70 billion in revenue. Compare that to the $40 billion deal by Elon Musk to acquire Twitter, and you may realize content deals should get a bit more love in the press. So as always, keep listening and enjoy. Welcome to the East Meets West podcast, a podcast about understanding Asia tech and how Asia tech affects the world. My name is Dan. Joining me, as always, from Astral Ventures, Albert. How are you doing?
Dan, I'm going good. Haven't heard that introduction before. Very nice.
It's a fresh one. Trying it out. User feedback appreciated. But yeah, leaning into our move into East Meets West this week's episode.
I love it. This will be a fun episode. I'm really excited for it. We're talking about, I guess, like top content deals in Asia, or I've got like Asia adjacency. And obviously, you know, if you've listened to this or you've listened to the previous two episodes or on our primers, the first on software and the second on content, you'll understand what we're talking about. But today, diving really deep into content and talking about, you know, the top five content licenses or acquisition deals.
Yeah, so the structure of this week's episode, we'll keep it simple. Albert and I are going to go back and forth with some of the biggest deals that we see emanating out of Asia or relating to Asia. Then we'll sort of chat about why it was a good acquisition, if it was a good acquisition, what trends does it reflect, and then ultimately we're going to give it a grade or a rating as to how successful that acquisition has been, or if it's a recent one, you know, how we think it's going to go. And then as we wrap up at the end, we'll talk about, you know, what's on the shelf, what IP or content is out there that might be ripe for acquisition, and what might it be used for, how might it be sort of re-evolved, reimagined in the way that the Marvel Universe has, and just think about, you know, how that could impact all the stuff that's going out there with the streaming wars, with Netflix, with some of the big movie production studios. Because everyone, Albert, is out there looking for the next big hit.
Yeah, there's no doubt that people are out there looking for the next big hit, and that, you know, it's very difficult to write and come up with original storylines. So naturally, the best way to do it is to find story and content that's already been produced, that already has an existing fan base, and then just monetize that. We've seen Marvel run that playbook. We've seen Disney run that playbook, sorry. And so I think it's really important that, you know, we talk about what could potentially happen this year.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to start out the pod by just giving a bit of a sense of scale to some of these deals. You know, we're not hitting on the Star Wars, or the acquisition of Lucasfilm Star Wars by Disney, but, you know, that's an acquisition where it's worth billions and billions of dollars. You know, the total revenue of Star Wars as a franchise is $65 billion. So I think, and this is one of the reasons we're touching on it in our podcast, focusing on it in East Meets West, is the future is content. There is so much money tied up in content, the value of the content, the distribution of that content, that, you know, it's one thing to talk about the biggest company acquisitions. It's just as important to talk about the biggest content acquisitions moving forward.
Yeah, definitely. And content really makes or breaks a lot of these businesses as well. Like, if you imagine what Disney was, you know, a number of years ago, and I guess we're talking about Disney because they've got this playbook of content acquisition versus what they are today and some of these companies we're going to talk about. Like, having great content is fundamental to running a really successful content or like content adjacent business.
All right, Albert, do you want to hit us with the first content deal?
Look, let's do it. I think, you know, starting relatively recent, I'm not going for the biggest deal, but I'm talking about one that kind of became the zeitgeist. I'm talking about Netflix and Squid Game. So Squid Game was a Netflix original. It cost them about $21 million to produce. So when I talk about the biggest deal in terms of acquisition, licensing, or production really leaning on the production side of things with Squid Game. If anyone hasn't, you know, watched Squid Game, which I'd be surprised if, you know, you haven't, it's a TV show on Netflix or a limited series, ran for about a season with a second season coming up. It's effectively this kind of dystopian horror thriller show where a group of Koreans, and it's based in Korea, have been kidnapped and are forced to play a game where they've got to play little exercises or like go through these, I don't know, like survival games, tasks.
Challenges.
Yeah,
yep, games. Survival tasks. Yep.
Challenges is a good word. Survival tasks is, I guess, another way. In the hopes to win 4.5 billion in Korean dollars. I can't remember what the Korean currency is, so apologies for that. But the key and the horror element to that is that these are like death-inducing games and challenges. So I won't go into it in too much detail so I don't spoil it, but people don't survive the challenges. So in the very first episode, there's a figurine, a giant figurine. They play red light, green light. It's a children's game, but if you get caught during a red light, you get shot at. So the numbers quickly dwindle down. You get heavily involved and invested in the characters. There's a bit of mystery element as to like who organized the Squid Game, who's behind it all. Is the money real? You know, there's elements of like social class when it comes to, you know, different people participating in the games. You know, people watch the game. So, you know, it's not just a random survival game that someone's created. It actually gets broadcast. And so there's lots of different elements of like classism and things like that.
It's a bit meta, isn't it, Albert? We're talking about content deals and there's content within the content with broadcasting of the Squid Games.
Yeah. Well, I mean, content is king, as they say, and content within content just makes for a royal family.
So one of the things I wanted to unpack about this one, Albert, and particularly is to query, like, why is this one of your top deals? I mean, it is a franchise which I think really caught everyone by surprise. It's what was unique for it for me is if you sort of drew this up in a lab, if you're like, try and create a viral TV show, I don't think anyone in that lab would have thrown into the pot, you know, subtitled television show, lots of gore so it doesn't appeal to, you know, kids' audience as well. It's like quite specific. And I think there's a lot of things there which if you were just in the drawing room, you probably wouldn't have thrown into a viral hit, but here we are. So like, what's the takeaway from Squid Games, Albert? Is it just one hit wonder? Like, why is this one of your top deals?
Yeah, there's probably two ways I'm going to answer this. The first is what it means for Netflix, and then I guess what it means also from like a performance perspective. And so for Netflix, they were kind of at this intersection where they were trying to expand into international markets, and part of that was acquiring international content. So Korea is obviously a very big market for them in terms of not only subscribers, but the content. And a number of years ago, they were making no content in Korea, and now they've obviously ramped up. Squid Game was the perfect on-ramp for Korean content. So when I say Korean content, it's like content produced in Korea or content about Korea. Up until then, it was really just K-drama, and there's not many people who watch K-drama. Now, Korean content has kind of exploded on Netflix. You've got a bunch of different horror-esque, you know, TV series. You've got one of their most popular ones at the moment, Extraordinary Attorney Woo. I don't know, Dan, if you've seen that because, you know, you're a lawyer as well, but no. One of their most popular shows at the moment, about 400 million worth of viewing hours so far, they talk about in the earnings call. But from an international content perspective, trying to onboard people onto international content and Korean content in particular, I think Squid Game came at the right time and its success came at the right time for Netflix because now it's been this on-ramp for people, particularly Westerners, to come in and watch, you know, Korean content and understand and, you know, get used to watching things with subtitles or really bad dubs, get used to like these like wacky storylines that probably couldn't have been cooked up for a Western audience by Western writers.
Yeah, and I think that's an important observation because while we've seen globalization in business as businesses go cross-country and all of that, content actually has not really crossed many borders. Like if you think of the difficulties in translating material across cultures, as you said, Albert, the different kind of tastes in terms of bringing things across cultures, I know for, you know, looking at Indonesian content, there's something about the way the actors do things, the way the show's presented, that feels a bit cheesy or corny, which isn't really my taste, but would be something that for a local person in Indonesia would be quite familiar and therefore interesting. So I think this globalization of content really needed a trigger, an instigator to, as you say, Albert, get people sort of familiar, comfortable with the idea of clicking on something foreign. There's probably perhaps a thought that foreign films was a bit bougie, you know, like arts festival, movie festival type material. But now this took it into the mainstream. And what that does is it just really opens up, as I think we'll get to talking about, Albert, a potential library of content, which doesn't mean we have to reinvent the wheel, doesn't mean you have to create and develop new content. You can take something that was popular in a country and then just translate it, dub it, maybe update a little bit, and then send it out into the world. That, I think, is going to be a frontier that we're going to see more of in the next couple of years.
Such a good insight, Dan, that I hadn't thought about around watching or consuming, you know, international content is like a bougie thing to do. And it's not necessarily something, you know, like normalized. And now it is becoming normalized. I think before we close off Squid Game, I just want to throw out some stats and then we can move off. Costs about $21 million to produce, and at the moment, you know, leaked documents say it's netted around $900 million. So it's like a 40x return on the production costs, which is, you know, crazy. More than 2.1 billion viewing hours. It's won 6 Emmys. Season 2 is meant to come out. They're creating a video game, and they've even created a game show based on the game where people can win real money. So great, great success for Netflix.
A game show based on the game where you can win real money but not die, hopefully.
Yeah, well, yeah. Fingers crossed. I think Netflix will be in a world of hurt if it's not the case.
All right, let's get to my first big content deal, Albert. And this is one we have sort of talked about before, and that's Riot Games. It's kind of hard, particularly on the podcast, when we're talking about some of the biggest gaming companies, to not talk about Riot Games, to not talk about League of Legends. But many people don't, or they're not quite aware, that in February 2011, so almost 10 plus years ago, very early on days to Riot Games, League of Legends wasn't a big hit then, Tencent bought them out, paying $400 million for a 93% share of the company. And ever since then, they've been a subsidiary of Tencent. Riot Games' current valuation is well above $20 billion. That is just, I'm gonna spoil the ending of this little content deal, Albert. This is an A-plus deal. Now, the return that they've got on this, and it's growing, is just absolutely phenomenal. And for those that don't know, sort of League of Legends, or LOL for short, it's a PC online multiplayer game, a MOBA. It was developed by Riot Games, but it's also been spun out into a mobile game, so not on just PC. They've got League of Legends Wild Rift, which is for people into mobile gaming, and they've got a very, very popular Netflix show, Arcane, which got lots of, you know, rave reviews. So they're starting to spin out their universe into first it was PC gaming, then mobile gaming, now sort of Netflix anime cartoons. There's a big universe here to unpack, and it's underpinned by 150 million average monthly players, just like a huge base to draw on. This, to me, is one of the biggest content deals, and it's still evolving and growing.
This is no doubt an A-plus acquisition in my mind. I think, you'll be more familiar with this, but did League of Legends really spark the gaming into content, like more broader content trend that we start to see outside of, you know, traditional things like Pokemon, etc.?
Totally. Like if you look on Twitch, if you look at like the top streamers, a lot of them are League of Legends streamers. So like that sort of crossover of content and gaming, a big pioneer for League of Legends.
Yeah, and then across kind of the spectrum of esports, is League of Legends one of the biggest, if not the
biggest?
It's
one of the biggest esports, yep.
Yeah. So then it's like a category-defining acquisition in terms of content itself, because not only does it like breed more content avenues and opportunities for revenue, it's like transcended the peak of what it means to be a game, right? Like people play this game competitively and put their lives to it. It's no longer a game to them.
Well, exactly. And you've got people, you know, in similar ways to traditional sports, where they have tough upbringings, tough backgrounds, and they go on to be, you know, a millionaire footballer, basketballer, whatever the case might be. And you have the same stories, you know, frankly, emanating out of Asia, where they're, you know, really, really young people, 14, 15 years old. They just spend every day at a PC arcade, sort of escaping from things. And then they break through esports, through the game, and they essentially owe their livelihood to the game. So there is a big, big ecosystem. I think there's definitely some criticisms where there's lofty ambitions for the esports scene, for League of Legends, for Riot Games to really expand. And it's probably tough for those growth numbers to continue into perpetuity. But if you, I think, just taking a fair, objective look at how they've performed with what they have, they are really grinding out a long-lasting, sustainable franchise in an industry which is known for quite short-lived franchises. Like, it's exceptional to have a franchise that's decades old at this point.
Yeah, if you're, you know, in Tencent and Riot Games, Stan, and you look at your portfolio across League of Legends, and obviously gaming is just going to be part of the business that keeps ticking away. It's effectively your cash cow, if you want to put it in the traditional 2x2 consulting matrix. Like, what are the other areas that you'd want to see Riot Games really push and invest into to grow this brand into one of those, like, enduring franchises?
To me, it's about mobile gaming. So I mentioned that they've got a mobile version of their game, Wild Rift. You know, compared to their 150 million average monthly players on the PC version, they've got about 6 million average monthly players. And that pales in comparison to what I think is rightly a kind of copyrighted knockoff Mobile Legends, which you're probably familiar with, Albert, because everyone in Asia plays Mobile Legends. That's got 80 million monthly average players. So they're actually losing in Asia in mobile gaming to a competitor that kind of ripped off their product. Like, if you look at the characters, the gameplay, it's all very much copied across. So that, to me, I think is a big challenge for them. We've talked before about how Asia, the penetration of PCs compared to mobile phones is much, much less. If you want to win in gaming in Asia, you do need to start turning on that funnel for mobile gaming.
Yeah. Is there crossover between, like, the games and Riot Games portfolio you see coming? Like, they've obviously got League of Legends, they've got Valorant, which is one of their other big games. You know, players who play either of those games aren't mutually exclusive. Like, people will play both, not just one, because they are really good games. And I played a bit of Valorant over the summer break, you know, just, you know, jumping on my younger brother's computer and playing. It's fun. Like, do you see that crossover intersection happening within their portfolio?
I do. And this is where I think what makes Riot Games a bit unique is it is a universe. So when you look across, they've got what started all, League of Legends, which is a MOBA multiplayer online battle arena type game. But then they've got Teamfight Tactics, which uses the same League of Legends characters, but it's essentially a card game. You know, if you think of Magic the Gathering or some of the other card games that are out there. And then they've got mobile gaming. So they've got different pieces of their IP, which they're using across different types of games. And as you say, Albert, I think that crosses over where you're going to have same player base saying the different games, because maybe on one day they want to play this, on another day they want to play something else. But importantly, I think it means they're also broadening their reach. So someone who only wants to play MOBAs, yes, they've captured them, but someone who really likes playing that card game type of video game, they're capturing that audience as well as the crossover. And that's, I think, an important difference. If you really like Call of Duty, you only really like shoot 'em up games. There's no sort of like Call of Duty card game or board game or those sorts of things. That's where Riot Games really sets itself apart and broadens its audience.
Yeah. What does it take for something like Riot Games, League of Legends, or content and gaming around that space to broaden out from being incredibly popular within the gaming community to incredibly popular globally? Because I think of them as very distinct things if I compare something like Mario, which is a global phenomenon. Everyone's familiar with it, even if you're not a gamer, versus League of Legends. Like, someone, I don't play League of Legends, so I couldn't tell you who the characters are, despite me being, you know, in this space. But I'm sure you could pick someone off the street and be like, who's the main character in you know, Mario Kart or whatever. Obviously, it's in the name. But
it's in the name.
It's in the name. But, dude, you know what I mean? How does Riot Games break down the barrier that enables it to go from something specific in the gaming community to something more broad?
Yeah, I think you've picked a good example there because it's distinguishing. The playbook for Riot Games isn't Mario, it's not Zelda, it's not, you know, some of these franchises based around a named iconic character. I think the playbook is Pokemon. How did Pokemon get big? Well, they went from having the game to having the TV show cartoon. And every day, Albert, we would wake up at 7, 8 a.m., watch Cheese TV, and pop on Pokemon in the morning. That's why I think the Arcane Netflix TV series, which they've sort of started producing, that to me is the signal that they do want to be mainstream. They do want their story, their universe to be known by the general public, by non-gamers. And that's the playbook. It's the Pokemon playbook, not the Mario or Zelda playbook.
It's crazy how the Pokemon playbook has just been so successful. It's probably a good segue into you know, the next content deal if you've got any closing thoughts on Riot Games, man.
A plus, let's move on to the next one.
Nice. I think so the third I've got, also another kind of modernish deal. I'm talking about Niantic and the Pokemon Company to create Pokemon Go. So Niantic licensed Pokemon and the Pokemon content. I think there's also minority investment involved, but the terms of that aren't, you know, hugely disclosed. I'm sure a lot of people will be familiar, but if anyone is not familiar, Pokemon Go is a mobile AR/VR game that uses the Pokemon IP and leverages that to create real-life Pokemon that you can see around you through a mobile AR device or using your phone. So how it works is you load up Pokemon Go, you know, the camera will take into account your surroundings. So I could be sitting in my living room, and then the game, using location-based data and a few other random bits of data it leverages in its algorithm, will generate Pokemon based on my location. So if I'm near water, it'll generate, you know, water-based Pokemon. If I'm in the city, like urbanized Pokemon and things like that, based on the game coding. So I could be in my room and there could be like a Pikachu in my room, and then I can go catch it. So it's like being a Pokemon trainer in the game, but in real life.
That's what games are about, taking the imaginary and bringing it to real life, which is, I think, is how Pokemon Go really, I think, captured people. That and the nostalgia factor, Albert, which might be something we get into in a little bit. But just talking about this as a content deal, Albert, breaking down the mechanics of it a little bit, who is Niantic? And also, let's just sort of break down, they haven't acquired the television rights to Pokemon, some of these other things. It really is a quite specific kind of license deal. So what were the specifics of this deal, and why is that sort of a game changer trend moving forward?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, you know, the two parties involved, the Pokemon Company, you know, they're the founders and that they own and manage the IP associated with Pokemon, the series, all the characters, all the different Pokemon, the creatures, etc. Niantic are a set of game developers based in the US. They're kind of famous for this like geolocation game called Ingress, where people can go and walk around different parts of the city or where they're located and collect and do these different types of like geolocation missions. What Niantic did was they took a very similar model of Ingress, you know, location-based missions and location-based information using AR, and then put Pokemon into that kind of game engine. So instead of collecting missions and doing missions, you were going and catching Pokemon and battling gyms and trading Pokemon with other players. And so what the licensing deal was effectively to leverage Pokemon, the Pokemon Company's IP, the Pokemon, the Pokeballs, the trainers, etc., and then to create this augmented reality game called Pokemon Go.
And what's sort of the value that we're talking about that they've gotten from this deal?
Yeah, so really, really good question. So the deal terms weren't and haven't been disclosed, so it's hard to say what the return is. But so far, Pokemon Go is doing incredibly well. They're generating about $1 billion in revenue. It's been growing year on year with a very small decline in 2020. It's probably even worth noting that like this business, because it's like a mobile game, And because you can kind of walk around and play it, which is, you know, its intention is you go explore and play the game. It kind of just blew up during COVID. So there's been a huge spike in revenue because all you could do was kind of walk around. Even in cities where there was lockdowns, you could still go for walks. And that really drove a pretty big increase. It's got about 70 million players globally, which is, you know, a significant amount. Peaked around 130. So it's obviously declined significantly since its peak. But I'm just going to say they were all casual players because despite, you know...
Filthy casuals, Albert.
This is such a good tell. I mean, despite a decline in almost half its player numbers, its revenue's grown from like 130 million, 100 million in its first couple of years to over $1 billion now. And so that is a really, really good sign, even though that, you know, the player numbers have obviously declined significantly. The people who are playing it love it and are spending a lot of money on it.
So my takeaway from this deal, Albert, is it's kind of a... I think it's the first augmented reality type of content that has taken off. Like, I can't even think of... Not even on the same scale, but I just can't even think of any other AR type game which has really gained any kind of attraction or is in my periphery, in my awareness. Is that your sort of takeaway as to the trend here, that the big takeaway for this content deal?
100%. 100%. I think where the world's moving to is like this blend of AR, VR, and obviously the timing hasn't been right. You know, Pokemon Go was released in 2016, and since then there's, you know, obviously a lot's happened in the world, but this blend of content in real life hasn't happened. There's been kind of fringes of it. Snapchat, you know, can do a bit of augmented reality. You know, Pokemon Go is still going, but there's nothing really there that stood out and said, this is what it looks like when you blend digital content in real life, except Pokemon Go. And I think had Pokemon Go been released last year or this year or even next year, you know, as people talk about augmented reality headsets and different wearables, I think it could have been more successful. I mean, it already is very successful, but I think as a case study, you're absolutely right. Definitely one of the first. And I think they're a victim of being a bit too early.
That's an interesting point to maybe finish on, Albert, because what would you rate it? I would say probably a B+, because as you said, Albert, I'm kind of looking forward to, is this sustainable? What's the next step? Can they build a franchise? Doesn't even have to be around the Pokemon IP, but around the game type. You know, is this a model which is going to continue and that can actually sustain? So it's a B+ for now. It becomes an A+, I think, if in 5-10 years we're still talking about Niantic, they've added on more content or more games. That to me is what will make it a home run, essentially.
Yeah, I think what's been interesting about this is that they're one of the only kind of mobile games that's really fully integrated in a way with kind of its console originator. So Pokemon Core and Pokemon Go can be transferred into video game consoles, so that works out really well. So there's like this core element of like transferability and also an incentive to go buy a console if you're playing mobile and vice versa, which is like if you've got the console to then you know, play Pokemon Go. I think the other thing worth noting is they are experimenting with like the content within the game. They've got seasons, so like different like you know, volumes or like different special programs. I don't know how to call it without sounding like a boomer, Dan, but they've effectively got, because I obviously don't play this anymore, they've got like long-term Pokemon that you can catch, and then there's like Pokemon that are seasonal. They'll only come like every 3 months, or like an event Pokemon they can only catch at a very specific time. That keeps it fresh.
Nice. Ready to move on to our next deal, Albert?
Let's do it.
So next one I've got is Sony's acquisition of Bungie, which we touched on a little bit in our episode on Sony. So check that out if you want to see that breakdown and hear about Sony more generally, its content strategy, which is really, really interesting. But Bungie is famously the independent game studio and publisher of Halo, the Halo franchise, and Destiny. I think anyone our age, Albert, is very, very familiar with Halo. It was, you know, one of the big first-person shooters, really, really took off. I think it sort of had 80 million sales of its video games across the last couple of decades. So it really was a leading game franchise. And then they followed that up with the secondary franchise Destiny, which has got its sequel also out at the moment. These are really two big, big gaming franchises that Sony has acquired. And essentially, this acquisition happened within a couple of weeks of Microsoft acquiring Activision Blizzard, the big World of Warcraft gaming studio. So this has happened in the backdrop of your big gaming hardware producers, Microsoft for Xbox, Sony for PlayStation, obviously, kind of gearing up in this war for content, war for IP, to help grow the brand, grow the reach of their hardware, which we discussed in that Sony episode. So for me, this was a big deal, also in light of the other deals happening at the time.
This is such a spicy deal because Sony, obviously famous for their PlayStation console, Microsoft famous for their Xbox console. You know what's an Xbox exclusive? Halo.
It was, that's right.
Yeah, yep. And you know, back in the day, one of the big drivers to get an Xbox, the OG Xbox, Xbox One, was to play Halo. It was one of the flagship games on that console. So I don't know whether this is an acquisition that really stings for Microsoft, or whether they had the opportunity to go ahead with this acquisition and then chose not to. But I think it's really interesting when you look at this landscape and whether it's like, did Sony get to steal something from the jaws of Microsoft, or did Microsoft palm off something they didn't want to Sony?
Yeah, there's definitely that aspect to it, which is really, really quite interesting. But I think, as we mentioned in that episode when we were breaking down Sony, Albert, the fun thing here is thinking about who's going to own the stack for these big hardware games? Because it's almost, well, it's not a monopoly, but there's essentially Nintendo with Switch, Microsoft with its Xbox, PlayStation, oh, sorry, Sony with the PlayStation. For decades now, it's been those three consoles. Like, the console wars have revolved around these three players, and it doesn't seem like that's really going to move at all. So among those three players, and we've just talked about, you know, Pokemon, which is a Nintendo franchise, how is this race for exclusive content going to play out, which then drives sales to the hardware? And one of the key things about Bungie's acquisition was it's not just the IP, and this is one of the things I want to highlight in this particular content deal. The big thing that Sony wanted to acquire here was the engineering talent at Bungie. So by 2025, about 55% of PlayStation's budget is going to be on what's called live service games. And so that's where, you know, instead of just sort of booting up the disc or the game and you're playing offline by yourself, it's a live server. You're playing multiplayer with people from around the world. And that has a lot of complexities to it because you're playing a live game with potentially hundreds of players all in the lobby, shooting each other, running around, doing all sorts of stuff. That takes a lot of engineering expertise. And PlayStation and Sony are essentially saying, if we acquire Bungie, one of the preeminent studios in this space, then all the other games that we're going to be creating can leverage off that technology and expertise, which to me, Albert, shows a pretty stark trend towards people aren't going to be playing offline little sort of RPG games all by themselves. The future of gaming is this multiplayer universes. You're playing online, you're playing on live servers.
Yeah, agree. I think as a whole, Sony's done really well in the past decade to like amass great gaming IP. Like, I don't know whether that was necessarily true in like the early 2000s in terms of their gaming IP when you looked at the landscape. But now they've got, obviously, they've got Halo from Bungie, they've got The Last of Us, they've got Uncharted, they've got God of War. They've got an incredible set of IP because they've done all these kind of like content or gaming studio acquisitions. And so I would put, probably in addition to what you've got there, just like Sony's ability to choose the right gaming studios to acquire as like a world-class acquisition channel and acquisition funnel for them.
Yeah, so I think for this one, if we just skip ahead to ratings, because I really want to get to our last one and then some of the content on the shelf, I probably only give this a sort of C plus, B minus. And one of the reasons is it that the deal was seen to be a bit overvalued, particularly when you're looking at prospectively, you're hiring a bunch of developers. I think when they broke it down, Sony essentially paid $4 million per developer at Bungie, which is a very healthy premium. The IP rights, less relevant in the gaming world because you obviously want future game sales. You don't really benefit from past game sales. So to me, a really big deal, but we're going to have to wait to see more sort of proof of whether it works out in the future.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, well, we're coming close to time here, Dan. I think it'd probably be a good talk maybe for a couple of minutes about like what could have been or what has been coming into 2023 or content deals that you feel like have kind of missed the boat. I think I'll start really quickly. I think a few years ago, Disney and Studio Ghibli kind of ended their relationship. And I think that's really unfortunate for both parties. I think at the end, I'm kind of reading verbatim here and it's a lot of speculation. But in the end, Disney just didn't want to pay the premium for Studio Ghibli. And I think now that Disney are kind of reinvigorated under new leadership, they're looking for new IP. Bob Iger obviously thinks about his career as big deals and he's like a deal maker, deal machine. I think Studio Ghibli could potentially be back at the table.
Yeah, I think one of the ones for me, which is a little bit of a disappointment, is like a franchise like Transformers. And the reason I wanted to highlight that one is I don't think it's lack of imagination, but I think it's kind of, it's the original sin of how it was set up. Originally, there was sort of a Japanese toy studio and Hasbro, and there was this kind of janky joint structure where the actual game designer, toy designer, universe designer was Marvel, but Marvel under sort of a contract for the two other companies. So already it sounds a little bit complicated, and it's that kind of original sin which I think has really held up some of the licensing arrangements for Transformers. And it's those kind of things which I think it's a disappointment, because if there was just one owner, I think someone really would have monetized and distributed Transformers in a way that it's one of the leading movie franchises, merchandise franchises that we have. But because there's too many cooks in the kitchen, I think that's just going to constantly hold them back. In the same way that the Marvel Universe is held back by Spider-Man sort of being off on its own different licensing agreement.
Man, Transformers could have been an awesome franchise, like an awesome franchise if it was put under the right leadership. And unfortunately, that's just not the case. Like the IP itself is really, really cool.
All right, Ab, if we look ahead though, what's something on the shelf that you want to see perhaps change hands or would just be a game changer for content?
You know what? I'm really surprised that Zelda and The Legend of Zelda just doesn't have a bigger universe around it. Like to me, that's really, really cool IP as well. I'm just surprised that like it's just kind of gone nowhere. And why I say nowhere, obviously the games are huge, but there's a Zelda game like every couple of years, like every 4 or 5 years, if that. I think you'd be lucky to get a Zelda game at the same volume as you get, you know, other types of IP.
That's one that touches me close to my heart, Albert, because keep your hands off Zelda. I think it's one of the gaming sort of purest games, because if you notice, like Zelda, not Zelda, but Link, the main character of the game, doesn't speak. And as you say, Albert, they put out these games every 4 or 5 year cycles. To me, it's one of those franchises which has such a focus on quality on the game itself that it's kind of like if we do market it out, if we do distribute it, it kind of taints the product. So not saying that it's not in the future, but sort of the gamer in me wants it to stay untouched. Some of the ones that I'm looking for, Albert, and these maybe aren't gaming franchises so much as gaming studios, Square Enix, which is behind Final Fantasy, Kingdom Hearts, and several other franchises. Dragon Quest is another really, really big one. To me, like that's an interesting one. That's one where, as part of some of the Final Fantasy games, they've released, you know, DVD movies with the same characters, things like that. But to me, I've always seen those to fail because it's a game studio trying to produce other content. I'd really love for a proper content studio, content stack to acquire them, give them full reign and independence over the gaming aspect things, but say, look, hold on, Square Enix, we're really going to take your product global because they've got some mad characters that I think the world would love.
Yeah, that's another one where I think the gaming content, the characters are really great. And I know they kind of played around with like film and things like that. It didn't really go anywhere. Square Enix up there for me as well. I think one other one I do really want to talk about is probably not like a specific one that's sitting on the shelf, but more broadly a trend, is that shift of anime and manga into live action. So when I talk about Squid Game being a really good on-ramp into some of these like more like culturally specific stories that you see with like anime and more like Asian type content, like, you know, like heavily leaning into like the world has ended and here's like an apocalyptic situation or like here's a story that you would never see. You know, you got some pretty interesting ones coming out where Netflix are producing a live action One Piece. Yep. It's One Piece, obviously the most successful and most popular manga in Japan. And the original author is heavily involved in that project. A lot of people see it being very HBO Game of Thrones-esque because the amount of investment that Netflix has put into it. You know, we've also recently seen the success of Alice in Borderland, which has got two seasons on Netflix at the moment. I think there is this going trend of leveraging anime and Japanese stories into live action film successfully.
Yeah, put the finger on the pulse for that one. I'm not sold on live action. I think it's corny. I think it's one of those ones where you've got to ask yourself, like, does the story match the medium? And when you're dealing with supernatural characters, powers, all these kind of things, it feels really janky to me when you've got like real live people acting it out. But I want to see, am I just behind the curve? Like, is this one of those ones where it's just like people growing up in this new generation are going to love live action? I haven't seen the proof of concept, but that's one to monitor.
Well, I think it feels janky because it's just never had high investment. So to contextualize this, Netflix is putting $10 million per episode into the One Piece franchise. Game of Thrones cost about $6 million to produce per episode. House of Dragons is pushing around $20 million per episode. So yeah, in terms of the quality, you can expect it to sit in between like original Game of Thrones and where House of Dragon is from a production standpoint. I think because you've got someone like Netflix is willing to shell out cash, hopefully it feels like, you know, it's got high production value as opposed to like some of the jankier ones I've seen. And I just watched Alice in Borderland very recently over the Christmas period, and I thought that was great.
Anything else to comment on, Albert, before we finish up?
Look, I think you've talked about a lot of anime, TV. The only one I want to just throw out there is sport. And I think there's a really great opportunity to bring IPL out there further into kind of Western markets. You know, if anyone doesn't know IPL, Indian Premier League, it's cricket, but it's not really cricket. It's like cricket, but really fun. I think people love it. It's got an unbelievable amount of viewership. Right now, the streaming rights in the US are with Viacom because Disney actually lost it. They tried to get the licensing agreements to the IPL. And I think there's something there with an IPL.
That is out of left field, Albert. I did not see that one coming. A really great shout to end the pod. Let's finish up there. Thank you for listening to the East Meets West podcast, a podcast about Asia tech and how Asia tech affects the world. Support the pod. If you're not already, subscribe, rate 5 stars, etc., etc. Help us build the brand, and we'll see you again next week. Thanks. See ya.